Okay, it's Ask an Astronomer time, and thank you very much again to Dr. Tim O'Brien for coming along and answering your questions. Joining me is Stuart this time to ask the first question.
Yes, indeed, and the first question is from Gethin Jones, who's a physics teacher looking for some data to set up an activity for GCSE students involving plotting a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. And I think what they really want are some luminosity in suns and surface temperature in Kelvin for about 30 main sequence stars. So Tim, can you help us out?
Yeah, so this is just very, very quickly just to explain what that is to people who aren't aware. It's something that two guys did independently back at the beginning of the 20th century, Mr. Hertzsprung and Mr. Russell, surprisingly enough. And what they did was they sort of said, oh, we make sense of stars. What we'll do is we'll go around and make observations of them, look at their colours and look at their brightnesses. And then what they did was they plotted one property against the other on a graph, and you know, one hopes when you do this in science is that you rather than seeing just a scattered diagram where all the points are randomly scattered all over the place, there's some structure appears, and then that tells you that these properties are related in some way. And in fact, what they saw was that something like 90% of the stars lay along the diagonal band in one of these, you might call them a color magnitude diagram, color against brightness, basically. And that basically tells us that from a random set of stars, you know, if 90% of them lie along this diagonal band, which they called the main sequence because most of the stars were on it, that means that on average stars spend 90% of their life in that phase where they'd sit on that. So this is the HR diagram.
Right. And what stars would not lie on the main sequence then?
Okay, so the main sequence is basically where stars spend 90% of their lives. It's where they're turning hydrogen into helium in their cores, just like the sun is. The point where you are on the main sequence depends on the mass of the star. So the more massive the star, the higher up the main sequence is, it's hotter and it's brighter. The less massive the stars are, cooler and redder, so they're and fainter, so they're down to the bottom right. And the stars that are not on the main sequence are the ones that have either not quite formed and not started burning hydrogen into helium, so they're sort of pre-stars, really, proto-stars. And all the stars that have gone beyond that stage in their evolution, so we talk about the red giants, various types of sort of red giant, asymptotic giant branch stars, you know, white dwarfs, the end points of stars, those sorts of things. So basically stars move off the main sequence when they run out of hydrogen.
Where do we get these data from?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a good question, actually. And in fact, you know, what we'll do, I think, one of the simple things we can do is actually we can put the data that this particular listener is asking for on our website. So we can sort of say, okay, save you the trouble. We'll put it on the website and we'll give a few links to a few places where you can get it from. The sorts of places we'll be looking at are the sorts of surveys, like, for example, the Hipparchos survey, which was measuring the properties of stars, you know, out to a reasonable distance from the sun. And you can dig these things around on the web. But as he says, he'd done a lot of Googling and couldn't come up with anything. So we'll give him a shortcut.
Very good. Our next question comes from John Randall, and he writes, I remember reading somewhere that the spiral arms of galaxies are not stable, long-lasting features which go around as a galaxy rotates, like a Catherine wheel, but are more like waves continuously forming and fading away in different regions of the galaxy. Does this mean waves of star formation? And is this why the arms are brighter than the regions in between? How does this fit in with the observation in one of the recent Jodcasts that our sun has completed around 25 orbits of the galaxy since it was formed?
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, the fact that the sun's gone around so many times, when we started measuring the rotation speeds of stars in galaxies, it was realized that these spiral patterns would wind up. So you start with this spiral pattern, and if things are moving around as fast as they appear to be, as indeed they are, that spiral pattern, if it were fixed in the stars, you'd expect to have wound up by now. So why do we still see these spiral galaxies? And the theory that that we basically adhere to these days is something called density wave theory, or spiral density wave theory. And it's basically what our listener suggests, which is that there's actually waves that pass through the matter that makes up the disk of the galaxy. So the way to think about it is, you know, if you think about water waves, for example, you go to the beach, throw a plastic football in the water or something and watch what happens. You'll see the waves coming in onto the beach, but the ball will largely just move up and down as the wave goes past. So it's not actually the water itself that's moving towards the beach all the time. If all the water was moving towards the beach, be a serious issue. So in fact, what's happening is these waves that basically change in the depth of the water, on the surface of the water basically, are moving relative to the water. The wave moves through the water. So in this theory, what happens is there's a density wave, which means that there's a wave of a compression. The gas is squeezed to higher density in a wave pattern that sort of spirals, tracks its way around and around and around the galaxy. Now, of course, what happens if that's true, if the gas clouds are compressed as this wave goes past, that increases the chance that you'll bump a region of the cloud of gas up above what we call the Jeans mass, which is something that the physicist, astrophysicist Jeans came up with originally. You get above a certain amount of mass, a certain volume, that will then collapse under its own gravity, and you'll form stars. So what's happening is this wave's going past, compressing the gas, and stars are sort of dropping out of the gas being formed as you go along. Now, if that was sort of all it was, you've still got to do a little bit more thinking about it to work out why that leads to the observed properties of a spiral galaxy. And it's basically because if you imagine this spiral density wave making a mix of stars of different masses, then like we were just talking about with the HR diagram, in fact, the higher mass stars that are made are brighter, and the lower mass stars are redder. And in fact, it's the higher mass stars that burn up the hydrogen in their core at a higher rate, and so they don't live as long. So in fact, what you'd expect to see as a result of this density wave thing passing through is that somewhere just behind the density wave, because it takes a little bit of time for the stars to form, you tend to see the hot blue stars, bright, sort of bluer stars, the high mass stars. Now, you're also forming low-mass stars as well, okay? So there are some red stars, some smaller, less massive red stars around there as well. But what happens is those high-mass, hot, bright blue stars don't live very long and die in, say, supernova explosions, for example. And then, so somewhere farther behind the density wave now, there won't be any of those stars left anymore. There won't be any of those hot, bright blue stars left. You'll just have the red dwarf-type stars left behind. So you've got to imagine this sort of spiral density wave sweeping through, seeding stars, you know, dropping stars in its wake, and the ones that are closest to that wave are going to be the bright blue stars, and then sort of spreading out, trailing behind it way all the way around the galaxy are all these red stars. And so when you look at a galaxy, you take a snapshot of it now, you see this spiral pattern delineated by these hot bright blue stars, in fact, and that's what gives this a spiral galaxy its classic appearance.
I like to think of density waves as traffic jams, like you get on the motorway.
Mm.
In fact, there was a really great video made by some researchers in Japan. It was on the New Scientist blog, I think. And they had a circular traffic jam going around, which did make me think of density waves in galaxies.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, anybody who's experienced driving on a motorway or a highway or something, and you suddenly hit a traffic jam, and then you're sitting there grumpily, and then a few minutes later, however long it takes, you accelerate away out the far side of it, and you think, well, what was all that about? Where was this sort of roadworks or something? Well, in fact, you know, generally those things are a bit like they're basically like these density waves, the waves that move through the traffic, and if you could film those from above with a helicopter, you'd see these sorts of high regions of density of cars moving relatively. Cars would be going into the back of them and accelerating out the other side. And like Stuart says, this quite interesting video got round the problem of how you film it from the helicopter by effectively taking the motorway and winding it into a circle and having people drive round and round and try and make these patterns that track around the circle. Quite good fun.
Okay, next question is from Jonathan Parr. He says, if when we look out into space we are basically seeing back in time, is there a possibility that any of the millions of galaxies we see could actually be the early Milky Way, or does it just not work like that?
Well, I would say the simple answer is it doesn't just work. It doesn't work like that. I mean, just for example, what we're looking at is when, yes, the farther we look away from the Earth, the farther back in time we're looking. So, for example, you know, when we look at the Moon. We see the Moon as it was about 1.25 seconds ago, because light takes about 1.25 seconds to get to us from the Moon. If we look at the Sun, and of course we all Jodcast listeners will know we shouldn't look at the Sun in case we hurt our eyes, but if you imagine looking at the Sun, you'd see it as it was 8 minutes ago. If you look at the nearest other star, we see it as it was about 4.5 years ago. So it's all just to do with distances and the fact that light travels at a finite speed. You just work that farther and farther and farther away. You're going to see distant galaxies as they were millions, even billions of years ago. Of course, we're not seeing ourselves in that. We are still where we are. The only way around that, I think it's sort of an interesting idea, is that maybe the universe has some bizarre topology that means that it's sort of folded back on itself in some way. So it might be that you can get, effectively get light paths that sort of go around the universe in some sense, and maybe you can look in one direction and see the back of your own head or something. That might be an interesting idea, but I think that's probably still not really proven yet. The basic idea, you look back in time, the farther away you look, you wouldn't really see yourself out there.
The next question is from Stanley Furtig, and he writes, a large part of the evidence for dark matter is the fact that galaxies appear to rotate, not like the solar system. The excess speed of the outer star's rotation argues for a distribution of mass which is not weighted towards the center, hence the dark matter halo. My question is, if dark matter does interact with matter, and presumably with itself gravitationally, then why is the dark matter halo not observed to collapse onto itself, at least in some cases?
Okay, so yeah, I mean, the summary of that, you know, the background to that is all perfectly correct. If all the mass, largely, you know, the majority of the mass of a galaxy was concentrated at the center, towards the center, then the velocities, the speeds of the outer parts of it, the rotation speeds, would actually reduce. They'd go like 1 over the square root of the distance from the center, actually. It's just from Kepler's laws, just like in the solar system. So we don't see that. We don't see the velocity, I mean, waddles about a little bit, but in general, the speeds and stuff tend to stay up higher above that 1 over the square root of the radius, almost flat, in fact, in some cases, hence the term flat rotation curves. We do believe that there's these dark matter halos extending way out behind, beyond the visible disk of the galaxy. So I would say, I'll invite Stuart in on this and yourself as well to discuss this if you like, but I would say one point would be, for example, if you just placed, a set of particles, a set of dark matter particles, whatever these particles that have mass and field gravity, just in position, stationary, in a big halo around a galaxy, then they would undoubtedly fall towards the middle because the gravity would pull them towards the central concentration. But if you started with these particles stationary in this thing, then they would, you know, they fall down towards the middle, but largely they just go straight through and back out the other side again, and you end up with the same thing again. Of course, in reality, what's happened is we've got these particles that are probably on orbits anyway, so that's, you know, that is going to happen. You're effectively going to keep your halo. How could you make this thing collapse then? How do you make the visible matter of the galaxy collapse?
Well, normal matter uses things like friction or radiation, so it can radiate away energy, and that helps it collapse down into the center, or by friction hitting other bits of matter.
Yeah.
But we don't have that with the dark matter.
That's right, yeah. So that's basically, I mean, this idea that the visible disk of a galaxy is this sort of flat thing is largely because it's been able to radiate away some of the energy of its motion to let it collapse to the middle, otherwise it'd just be on these, basically on these big orbits and sat way out, which is what the dark matter seems to be doing.
Mm. Our interview this episode with Dr. Andreas Falkenbacher talks a lot about the difference between baryonic, so-called normal matter, and the dark matter in the universe, so take a listen to that and listen to what he has to say about dark matter and normal matter.
Okay. Yeah, perhaps I shouldn't have called it normal matter, as only 5% of matter is made up of it.
Very abnormal matter.
Okay, I'm not sure whether this is allowed in the rules of Jodcast Asking Astronomer, but I want to just put in a question that I was asked that wasn't from a Jodcast listener, just this week, just a couple of days ago.
We'll let you off on this one.
So, in fact, I was telephoned at home on Tuesday evening, so that would have been the 9th of September, and I said, yes, Lou. And they said, are you Tim O'Brien? I said, yes. He said, you an astrophysicist? Yes. Who's this? And he said, oh, it's BBC Radio 5 Live. And I said, all right. And they said, would you come on the breakfast show tomorrow morning to tell us how the universe is going to end? So that was a rather more unusual question than we get from the Jodcast listeners.
Why, yes.
So of course, this is... this relates to the switch on of the Large Hadron Collider, the LHC, that happened on Wednesday morning, on the 10th of September.
And the LHC, for those who may have been on a different planet for the past few weeks, is a huge particle accelerator in CERN. It's near Geneva in Switzerland, and they've just started their new experiment.
Yeah, so I mean, the thing is, I mean, I guess I'm assuming, since it appears that most people in the world heard about this, that the Jodcast listeners will have heard about this, the question really comes from the fact that there was some talk of whether this this experiment was going to destroy the world, maybe even the universe, actually, when it was switched on Wednesday morning. Of course, what I did was I did my job, which is I explained to the researcher that this was not going to happen, and luckily enough, I've been proved right.
Wouldn't have made any difference, really.
No, I don't think you could have sued me. I explained to them why that wouldn't happen, basically, and we can perhaps have a little chat about that, and maybe also a little chat about what it might do for astronomy. Is that fair?
Yeah. Now that the universe hasn't been destroyed, we can still observe the universe. I mean, the whole issue about this was some theory that the LHC would produce, when the experiment was running, a black hole. A microscopic black hole, and of course we'd instantly therefore be sucked into it, and I'm not sure how the whole universe would go into there as well. But anyway, that's beside the point.
Eventually, maybe.
It would start with us, and we would therefore destroy mankind by turning this machine on.
You do have to wonder how the whole universe would be sucked into a microscopic black hole when there are plenty of supermassive ones around the place.
It's a good point, Stuart. In fact, you know, I mean, that's one of the points about black holes, isn't it? There's this classic sort of argument about, you know, what would happen if the sun turned into a black hole, you know, and the point is that we wouldn't all get sucked into it. In fact, we'd just carry on orbiting around it. We'd all get quite cold in about 8 minutes, it'd be quite dark as well, but we certainly wouldn't get sucked into it. So that's one part of the confusion about black holes, is they're sort of regarded as, you know, cosmic vacuum cleaners or something that suck up everything around them, and that isn't necessarily true. So the other argument about it is about this whole concept of, if it did produce these microscopic black holes, which, you know, it's actually regarded as being quite a small chance that that would happen, in fact, because it requires some breakdown of what we think is the standard interpretation of physics that we have at the moment. But if it did, why would that still not be a problem? Why would that still not cause the world to be destroyed? And I think there's a few arguments here. One is that it's thought that these very tiny black holes would evaporate away, and this is something called Hawking radiation. Is a prediction made by the famous physicist Stephen Hawking.
And this is in answer to another question which we received from Roger Gray, who asks exactly this. He asks, if black holes evaporate, what material escapes from inside the event horizon to cause this?
Yeah. So. We're going beyond the realms of standard astrophysics here, of course, and standard astronomy, but in fact what Hawking had done in this really is a sort of, maybe it's one of the closest ways we've come to looking at trying to unify quantum theory and gravity. So he's sort of it's an application of quantum physics to these regions of, you know, quite curved space-time, quite high gravity around these black holes. And the idea is that actually what might happen is, in the sort of these so-called vacuum energy fluctuations that you get in quantum field theory, where you can sort of popping out of the sort of foam, the vacuum sort of fluctuations you get in the universe, you get a particle-antiparticle pair. And if this happens quite close to the event horizon of the black hole, then actually you can get one, rather than normally, which would happen is that they'd pop up and then immediately annihilate and go back again into, and you just sort of popping up and disappearing all the time within the sort of realms of the uncertainty principle. Then what happens is one particle might actually escape away from the black hole, the other particle falls down into the black hole and can't escape from the event horizon. And the net result of that is effectively the black hole is radiating away these particles or energy, if you like, and so it therefore loses energy and evaporates. And this whole process, I think, is, you know, accelerates as the black hole gets smaller and smaller. And so quite quickly, very quickly, these tiny black holes would actually just evaporate away with a little burst of radiation from this Hawking radiation. That's one argument for why these things would not be a problem if they were formed. And there is another argument that just basically relates to the fact that we're all still here and have been here for some billions of years now.
We have, because as listeners to previous episodes will be aware, there are things called cosmic rays, which are very high energy particles from the space between the galaxies, which are constantly hitting our upper atmosphere, and in fact have energies far in excess of those in the collisions in the LHC. So we might have expected to have been had this happen already, with cosmic ray collisions in our atmosphere.
Yeah, so basically if this process happens in LHC collisions, it would presumably have been happening in these cosmic ray collisions all the time. These microscopic black holes will have been formed, and in fact, you know, presumably the Earth would have been destroyed already some a number of times over, in fact, and also looking around the universe in general, this process would be happening all the time to other planets, to neutron stars, white dwarfs, whatever. We just don't see any evidence for that. So I think that's probably true. I mean, of course, you know, just returning to the sort of theme of one reason why, another reason why the universe didn't end last Wednesday was, of course, because the LHC didn't do any collisions last Wednesday either. But maybe we should all worry for a month or two's time when they start doing the collisions.
Very good. So in the news, the LHC experiment has been referred to as the Big Bang experiment. So it's a particle physics experiment. So what's the connection with astrophysics?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, actually. I mean, I think in the UK, BBC Radio 4 had Big Bang Day, in fact, was what it was all day. It was Big Bang Day, and it was all about the LHC. And actually, you know, it was great because it certainly got people talking about physics, and that's quite hard to do. So, and these, you know, just your average person in the street was actually talking about this experiment. Now, you know, one can argue about this whole business about the end of the world. That certainly got people interested, and there's obviously a bit of a debate over whether that was a good thing, really, that we, it was a bit of a skirmonger thing. I did hear stories from people here that the kids at their school were, some kids were in tears, you know, they were crying about the fact that they thought the world was going to end, and it's, you know, we don't really want to be doing that, do we? But yeah, no, in general, it was great. People were talking about it. I got emails from people who I haven't spoken to for years just emailing me about it and just sort of asking me what was going on with it. So, in general, a very positive thing. I would say, I don't know what Stuart thinks about this or yourself, but I would say that I think calling it the Big Bang experiment seems to have got a bit out of hand, actually. I mean, I don't know whether, you know...
I mean, it is a Big Bang for protons.
It is, yeah. I mean, what they're really saying is that the energies of the collisions, that they smash these protons together, the energies that they're using in those collisions, those energies wouldn't are basically equivalent to energies in the universe, a sort of fraction of a second after the beginning of the universe, after the Big Bang. So they've approached... In terms of colliders, in terms of particle colliders, this is the closest that they've yet approached the conditions that were around at the time of the beginning of the universe in the Big Bang. Now, I think, you know, it goes too far probably calling it the Big Bang experiment, because really they weren't trying to recreate the conditions of the Big Bang in that sense. It wasn't really to do with the Big Bang. So, in fact, maybe it's seven times more energetic than the previously most energetic collider, the Tevatron. Mm. And, you know, obviously one could have called the Tevatron the Big Bang experiment because it approached the energies, you know, a bit later after the Big Bang, but still, you know...
A couple of seconds after the Big Bang.
Yeah, something like that. So it's sort of a bit, you know, I think that was probably a bit of a misnomer. Of course, it's, you know, it catches the eye and people are interested in things like the Big Bang. We know they're interested in astronomy. And it seems that the things that are sort of astronomically related, the Big Bang, the black holes, these were the things that were catching people's attention, actually, even with the LHC.
But the LHC is going to do lots of great physics, though, that's not necessarily related to cosmology or astronomy.
Yeah, absolutely. It is the superlative physics experiment. You know, it's going to, we hope, certainly probing the realms of physics that we've never gone into that regime of physics before. So it's an amazing physics experiment, and certainly should be. Is going to produce some incredible results. Quite whether it's really got much to do with the Big Bang or not, I'm not sure, to be honest. I suspect not. One of the possibilities is it may provide the first experimental evidence for the supersymmetric theories. And one of the candidate particles for dark matter is a supersymmetric particle. So it may be that they'll be able to produce particles, which we could then say, well, actually, at least these particles exist. At the moment, they're theoretically postulated, and people say, well, you know, perhaps these are the dark matter. If we can actually make them and see them in the lab, in this machine, then it takes you one step forward in the process, in the quest to work out what dark matter might be. I'm not sure that it would actually tell us that's what the dark matter particles actually are, but at least we'd have, you know, a good candidate that we have actually detected now. Hmm. Yeah, just talking about the publicity that it got as well, there's some interesting stuff, you know, there's some good questions being asked. I mean, one of the classic things that we get asked in astronomy was indeed asked of the physicists that are involved in the LHC experiment is, you know, what's the point of this? What's the, what, you know, isn't this a real colossal waste of money? And Brian Cox, who's actually one of the particle physicists here at Manchester, answered this question quite amusingly, I thought. He said, "Oh, no, the cost is peanuts," he says. In fact, it's less than peanuts.
Less than peanuts?
Less than peanuts, that's what his argument was. And in fact, what it was basically looking at the UK's subscription to CERN, the research institute that runs the LHC, something like £90 million a year or something like that, and basically said it's less than the amount of money that is spent on peanuts. So, you know, he was sort of pointing out that although, you know, obviously these things do cost money, you know, they do cost what sounds like a significant amount of money. When you compare it to other aspects of the economy, it's not actually quite as huge as you might think. One of the other interesting things was people talking about, there were a couple of guys talking about this, Simon Singh, who wrote a book on the Big Bang, I heard an interview with him where he was being asked about, you know, what's the use of this? What difference is it going to make to my everyday life? Again, a classic question asked of astronomers, and his answer was interesting. He sort of, you know, made the point that, you know, we don't do these things for spin-offs. We don't make the LHC. We don't build these telescopes that we use in order to make people's everyday lives better on a day-to-day sense. That isn't why we do it. It's for some other reasons. That's important to say, first of all. But he says that there often are spin-offs. You know, it's not that we're necessarily planning for them, but they come out. We can't necessarily predict them. And his point was, you know, we look at the LHC and we'll say, well, what are the spin-offs going to be? Well, we can identify some already, but maybe there's going to be some in the future. We don't know. And he harked back to the people that discovered the electron. And apparently they made a toast to the discovery of the particle electron. The toast was, here's to the electron. May it be of no use to anybody ever. And of course, you know, we're all completely dependent on it now. And they just couldn't conceive. You know, they were trying to understand where this electric charge came from, and they found it was this tiny particle. And didn't realize how that might be useful to anybody. And of course, you know, how could they know? But now it's ubiquitous. And I think that just a final point on that, Andrew Marr was one of the sort of political commentators that we see a lot on the TV and radio in the UK, was commenting on this. And he sort of made the point that, you know, I think is a good one, is that our whole modern civilization is based on science. We're a scientific society. You know, the fact that the way we live our lives is almost completely dependent on scientific advances. And it's exactly in these sorts of experiments and these sorts of blue skies things where we're not doing it necessarily for any particular particular spin-off or gain or technological advance. We're just doing it because there's a question that we have to try and answer. And he says, you know, if we're not going to do that, then, you know, we're not a civilization. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good point.
It is. And of course we should thank CERN for providing us with the World Wide Web. Indeed. Which otherwise the podcast wouldn't be able to get to you.
Absolutely.
Well, we look forward to when the LHC actually does start colliding protons, and maybe we'll end the universe then.
We'll see.
The podcast will continue past the end of the universe.
So thank you very much indeed to Dr. Tim O'Brien for answering your questions. Please do keep them coming in via the website. Just go to www.jodcast.net and follow the links to the question submission page.